Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchuk. On today's show, we'll hear a monologue I gave about the U.S. digital television transition and the months leading up to it, scheduled for June 12, 2009. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
President Barack Obama's American Recovery and Reinvestment Act included $7.2 billion to expand broadband services in unserved and underserved areas. The National Telecommunications Information Administration and the Rural Utilities Service are tasked with funding projects that will bridge the digital divide, which could include municipal broadband systems. Esme Voss is an intellectual property lawyer, business owner, and founder of the website MuniWireless.com, which has chronicled the highs and lows of municipal broadband projects since 2003. Voss says that communities that have done a good job planning their networks will have a better chance at getting funded.
They need to have done basically equipment costs and how much they're going to charge the residents, and then they should have done some kind of business plan so they have to have some idea of the annual operating cost of the network.
Voss says that some areas are too small to generate enough revenue to cover their operating costs. She says counties are coming together to pool resources and share funding. She suggests regional networks as another solution.
You get together and say, look, we're going to band together and put out one RFP, or we're going to do a survey together and we're going to put it out to bid, and then we'll buy everything together, and that way we can also link our networks so that it's not just these silos of networks, but that all these networks actually get linked.
Voss would like to see high-speed fiber optic broadband everywhere. But for some areas, getting fiber to each household is impractical, and rollout for underserved urban areas could be years away. She suggests that wireless services connected to a main fiber line can be employed to get individual buildings connected.
You can't do it fast enough, and people need broadband now. They needed it yesterday. So wireless, you know, this mix of WiMAX and Wi-Fi is absolutely the best, cheapest, fastest way to bring broadband to areas that do not have it today.
Voss says so-called net neutrality rules are important for any build-out.
The reason why we need certain rules in place is you want to make sure that whoever is getting government money to give broadband service to people doesn't pick and choose between applications that could compete with what he's offering. That's not good, because then you get a monopoly. There's a very basic freedom of speech issue there when the pipe and the applications that go through the pipe are controlled by one company.
Every time you hear a song played on the radio, royalties are paid to the composer and publisher, but the performers don't see a penny. That could be changing. The Performance Rights Act, H.R. 848, was introduced in Congress by Representative John Conyers of Michigan. The bill would require radio stations to compensate performers and record labels when their songs are played. Paul Porter, co-founder of Industry Ears, has been involved in the broadcasting industry for more than 20 years. Porter explains that the legislation is long overdue, and that artists and performers should also financially benefit from the radio airplay they receive.
In the past, it hasn't happened. Publishers who write songs, they get credit from BMI and ASCAP, and for a long time, it's been necessary that performers get paid, and it happens in 30 other countries, and it doesn't happen here.
The bill has passed out of one House committee already, but it is controversial. Broadcasters want to continue their exemption from paying a performance royalty, and they've been lobbying heavily against it. putting up ads across Washington and taking to the airwaves to rally opposition.
It's just amazing to me how the issues change from artists being paid to radio stations surviving. To me, the right thing to do is, you know, they've made stations so music intensive. That's their goal. So why shouldn't the artists be paid? That's how they garner their ratings.
Broadcasters have stepped up their attacks against the bill, claiming performance royalties will put already struggling radio stations with plunging revenues out of business. Others say the increased royalties will further narrow radio playlists. But Porter says that in many ways, the radio industry is its own worst enemy.
Radio's gone from serving local listeners to stockholders. And that's the real bad thing about it. Once it went corporate, you know, the only way to save a buck is cutting out services.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
The corporate media's stories on General Motors' bankruptcy read like obituaries, but they're covering the wrong funeral. The automaker's passing as an industrial giant marks the last gasp of industrial capitalism in the United States, and it was not a natural death. General Motors became the biggest corporation in the world when the United States was by far the biggest industrial power in the world. There has always been conflict between industrial capital, which actually manufactures things, and finance capital, which, left to its own devices, will reduce the manufacturing base to its various parts to be squeezed of value, sold off, or shut down. Two generations ago, finance capital got the upper hand in its battle with manufacturing capital and began to de-industrialize the United States. It was a long process, but a steady one, part of finance capital's global race to the bottom that would transfer the world's production to the low-wage south and east of the planet. The handwriting was on the wall for General Motors and the entire industrial sector of the U.S. economy back in the mid-80s, when GMAC, the financial arm of General Motors, surpassed the car-making part of the company in profits. Almost immediately, GMAC went into the mortgage business. From that moment on, it was crystal clear that the finance capitalists would eventually destroy the industrial capitalists. Then a funny thing happened on the way to finance capital's total conquest of America. With the keys to state and federal government in their hands, and the black soon-to-be president in their pockets, the investment banking class imploded of its own contradictions. Having succeeded in amassing trillions while creating nothing useful, the finance capital parasites proceeded to the next stage of their pathology, creating vast amounts of fictitious capital called derivatives based on nothing. The house of cards collapsed. The financial meltdown was near total, but their political power was undiminished. Just as they had controlled the outgoing Republican White House, they took charge of economic policy under the incoming Democrat. Barack Obama put the finance capitalist Steve Rattner in charge of finally bankrupting the auto industry, which left economist Stanley Aronowitz has described as the largest exercise in union busting in U.S. history. President Obama's own website brags that his White House was even more aggressive than the Bush administration in wrenching concessions from the United Auto Workers Union. The new GM, now 60% owned by the people of the United States, will be allowed to build small cars in China. Obama apologists actually believed that the unused auto infrastructure might be massively converted to building public transportation or other green industries. They failed to understand that Obama is the banker's president, and the bankers build nothing useful or productive. That is the crux of the current crisis of capitalism, the refusal of capital to invest in productive enterprise except under conditions of extremely low-wage labor. Nothing will replace General Motors until the bankers and the politicians who serve them are driven out of power. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripinchik. We now feature a presentation I gave about the U.S. digital television transition. The following monologue was recorded on Sunday, June 7, 2009. In this monologue, I will discuss the digital television transition in the United States, and particularly its history since the beginning of calendar year 2009. The history of that kind of stems back to what it was in the years prior to that, where the main bodies regarding the digital television transition in the United States, the Federal Communications Commission, Congress, and the broadcast lobby, in particular the National Association of Broadcasters, an infamous trade group on behalf of commercial radio and television broadcasters, they had basically been the major players regarding what was to happen regarding a transition where all analog broadcasting in the United States would cease to be replaced with digital broadcasting. There are good technical reasons for doing this, but the way it was done would basically leave a lot of flaws and also leave a lot of very vulnerable people even more vulnerable, particularly since a lot of remaining analog television users ranked among the very poorest and most vulnerable communities in the United States. And so were, ironically enough, the least able to act with this transition. And this has gotten a growing amount of criticism, particularly with very little that was actually done on behalf of the current regime, an FCC led by Republican Kevin Martin, members of Congress, and a White House that was basically unresponsive for years about concerns for poor people. And what happened was, I had thought personally that by the end of calendar year 2007 that a digital television transition was not going to remain in place on February 17, 2009. In January 3rd, 2009, that was there were a couple of things that helped to change that very dramatically. One was that we had the beginnings of a new regime at the FCC with both Deborah Taylor Tate and Kevin Martin, two of the standing Republicans on the commission, had left, which basically left a Democratic majority at the FCC for the first time in a long time, now chaired by acting chairman Michael Copps, a gentleman who I've met on a number of occasions and who, as media policymakers go, has been very good on media-related issues and certainly on the digital television issue, where he had actually described the potential negative ramifications of a digital transition is the mother of all consumer backlashes. So that was a new regime. You had a new Congress that was more responsive to this. And also, more importantly, you had a new president who was far more responsive on media matters, and it actually said so in a lot of his public pronouncements, at least during the campaign, regarding digital television, net neutrality, media concentration, and so forth. Couple these changes with a couple of developments. One is that the digital television transition itself had used as basically the hallmark of its address to the neediest of members of communities around the country a voucher program whereby people could buy digital converter boxes to be able to convert analog digital signals into analog equivalents for existing analog sets so that people wouldn't need to buy a new TV set and could just buy this converter box. And also a supplemental program where each household was eligible for two $40 coupons that could be used to help offset the cost of a digital converter box or boxes or other digital media. That sounded great, but there were a host of problems regarding this program, not the least of which was that the program, when January rolled around, had announced that it had run out of money, and in fact actually had done something that I didn't expect was going to happen. and I was pretty chicken little about these things myself, it established a waiting list. And that waiting list very quickly had grown up to probably about 3 or 4 million names asking for one of these vouchers to help to offset the cost of a converter box. So what happened? Well, it turns out that a number of activists had joined in with a conference call with the transition team of that was basically appointed by the incoming Obama administration to help to sort out and straighten out a number of matters related to media-related matters, including the new FCC. The two people who were tasked with this are both very good academics who have also been involved in political activism on media. Kevin Werbach, who's on the faculty at the University of Pennsylvania, and Susan Crawford, who's on the faculty at the Law School of the University of Michigan, and who have both been very involved in very positive ways, both on media-related matters. They were basically in charge of this transition period of sorts. And they were talking, there had been a lot of concern that they were hearing, and were basically trying to weigh various options to help to improve, smooth things along. The decision that wound up being arrived at to help to both facilitate a more equitable transition and to help to mitigate the problems was to postpone the deadline. The deadline there was even a bill, the DTV Delay Act, that was basically facilitated to help to move things along, moving the date from February 17th to June 12th, 2009. As this broadcast airs on June 11th. That means that tomorrow after midnight, the all analog high power television broadcasting in the United States will end forever. It bought about 4 months worth of time, a little bit more than that, for buying time to get more money to help to address some of the more pressing matters related to the digital television transition. And that's what I think the lion's share of this remaining monologue is going to be about. Where do we stand since that February 17th extension? The FCC, led by Michael Copps, has to its credit actually not given a blanket waiver to a lot of the television stations in the United States who wanted to all go digital on February 17th, actually as the law allowed, if the FCC granted it. About 500 or so television stations in the United States had asked the FCC for permission to convert on February 17th, as the previous law had originally indicated, and for which those stations had prepared for a number of years to get ready for that date. Now suddenly the rug was pulled out from under them, and a lot of stations were asking to have to convert on February 17th as originally planned. The FCC was the body that basically could grant an up or down vote as far as whether or not a given station could convert. About 500 stations asked for the privilege to do so. About a quarter of those stations were actually rejected for the reason that if it turns out that television broadcasting of an emergency nature or that wouldn't serve those neediest people in the United States were to go off without a suitable backup plan in place, then the problem there lay that that would be harmful to the public and wouldn't be in the public interest. And so the FCC, to its credit, actually rejected a fair number of application requests. They did grant a number, and a number of those stations have ceased their analog broadcasting. The remaining 3 months were kind of a lull as far as things go regarding at least the immediate policy ramifications of where we stood. But there was a lot of activity, certainly to help to fulfill money, upwards of about $630 million of money from the stimulus package that was passed by Congress, ironically enough, on February 17th, or very close to it, that gave the money necessary for a digital conversion to happen. Couple that with additional outreach, additional measures to help people in their immediate needs. And where we stand since then of all of this activity that hasn't gotten a whole lot of play, even among the business and among the media activist community. Well, you've had a number of developments. One development was that on June 3rd, the FCC's monthly meeting that they hold, a public meeting where they basically will announce and vote on various policy matters, will addressed the DTV conversion very prominently. In fact, that was basically the big focus of the June meeting that took place on June 3rd. What I'm going to read now are quotes from the very excellent Benton Foundation website at benton.org, B-E-N-T-O-N. It's a foundation that has focused on media and policy matters and has a very excellent website where they also have a newswire of recent stories on various matters. One matter that they present are these very nice capsule summaries of recent news. Here's one recent summary that you find from the Benton Foundation website. The Federal Communications Commission monthly meeting for June 2009 focused on what else? The transition to digital-only television broadcasting on June 12, 2009. The FCC says it is far readier than it would have been for the February 17th deadline, but that concerns remain. This is not a drill, said Acting Chairman Michael Copps, who said there would be no delaying this date, though we also said Congress and the president not move the date up initially. The transition education effort would have been a, quote, debacle that makes new Coke look like a marketing genius, unquote. Bernadette McGuire-Rivera, who is heading up the coupon program box program at the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, said she believed there would be enough money to send out the DTV to analog converter box coupons, while Christopher McLean of the Consumer Electronic Retailers Coalition said there would be enough boxes on store shelves. In fact, he said there would be likely an overall surplus. But there will be disruption, said FCC Chairman Acting Chairman Michael Copps, saying that the FCC could not accomplish in 4 months what should have been done in the past 4 years. That, I think, would echo my assessment there. There's been a lot of improvement there, and also that delaying date was very critical to help to improve things tremendously. That said, though, this is the kind of thing that takes years to do to be able to outreach to everyone who stands to be affected, and this is not the kind of thing to be done lightly or even quickly. You're finding problems along the way, and here are some of those problems. For example, the Federal Communications Commission, also quoting from Benton, announced that 35 full-power television stations that have been broadcasting in analog said that they will be ceasing operation entirely on or before June 12th, meaning they won't start digital operations after they pull the plug on analog. 17 of these stations are having technical difficulties, and the FCC said it expects them back by the end of the year. 18 of the stations are owned by one company currently in bankruptcy, Equity Media, while 7 of the 35 stations are affiliates of a major network. The FCC said it would try to reduce that number that would go dark, pointing out that some of the Equity signals would still be available on the multicast channel of another digital station. There's more. There was one concern that had been raised regarding the FCC, regarding various pay TV offerers, cable, phone, and satellite television offerers who would have taken advantage of the situation. And indeed, that is what has happened, and the FCC has actually said so. Again, to quote from Benton, at the FCC's meeting on the digital television transition, cable television was, one, praised for its cooperation with broadcasters to help educate viewers about the switch and its coordination with broadcasters and technical issues, and two, criticized because some operators are trying to use the transition to upsell their service, promising low-cost basic as a way to gain customers, then trying to sell them more expensive service rather than clearly laying out their options. Another story from Benton Foundation reads, with 10 days remaining, this being published on June 2nd, 10 days remaining before the transition to digital television on June 12th, the FCC is providing boots on the ground, messages over the airwaves, help over the phone, and answers in cyberspace for consumers who still need help preparing for the switch. The level of preparedness has steadily increased since Congress delayed the digital transition in February. The gap of unready households across America has narrowed by over 50% in the past 6 months, based on Nielsen data. In January, 5.7% of U.S. households were estimated to be unready for the DTV transition, and that number has now dropped to 2.7%. However, that 2.7% represents about 3.1 million homes nationwide that risk losing free over-the-air television unless they act before June 12th. Over the next 10 days, the FCC will be issuing a drumbeat of daily messages designed to highlight the most important issues concerning the impending nationwide transition. In addition to this media information campaign, approximately 250 FCC staffers will be working with the public at events and DTV clinics nationwide, while the commissioners will be traveling the country for local DTV events and making television and radio appearances in target cities. There's been a lot of highlight regarding what industry and the government has done, but there's one particularly notable community initiative that has been really taking a lot of energy and a lot of effort and very effectively and very efficiently, with hardly any or very little cost, been able to raise awareness about the issue. There's a community initiative called MAGNET, M-A-G-N-E-T, the Media Access Group Network, which is a coalition of local and community media activist groups across the United States. And MAGNET groups decided to design and carry out a socially responsible DTV transition campaign, to quote from their website at magnet.org, MAGNET.org. This socially responsible DTV transition campaign sought to A, address the racial and economic inequities and resulting disparities in the DTV transition, B, maintain and expand media access for people of color and poor people in the regions most impacted, and C, introduce the framework of socially responsible media regulation into the public debate on a specific media rule or policy. MAGNET, in a report posted on the MAGNET website, had posted both a report, an extensive report, as well as a summary report of a multi-month campaign that MAGNET groups were involved with. In this report, or in one of the reports, they quote, they write, and I'm quoting, "The role government plays in the DTV transition is a good indication of how they will handle future issues of digital access and inclusion. MAGNET wanted to demonstrate the role government should play while mobilizing regional organizations and leaders as a front line of service and action, engaging thousands of people from underrepresented communities. 1. Secure commitments from local and national retailers to carry a $40 DTV converter box with analog pass-through capability and closed captioning. 2. Raise awareness of the transition and frame the transition as an issue of racial and economic justice, as well as a human right to information access. 3. Build the membership base of MAGNET members. And 4. Establish the MAGNET through the anchor and partner groups of the network as the leading voice for grassroots media policy." How they were doing this, a number of tactics of this campaign approach that were involved. 1. Grassroots policy advocacy. 2. Establishing regional DTV assistance centers. 3. And there were a number of them in like maybe 8 cities across the United States. 3. Using community-based culturally competent public education to not talk down to communities, but to talk with communities and to use the resources and intelligence of various communities, not pretending that people are automatically dumb because they may not know about these things. They may be very smart, they may still not know these things, but to respect and acknowledge different cultures and different cultural traditions and work with that rather than talk down to it. That was one approach. And fourth approach was a collaborative retailer action and communication campaign to actually talk with a lot of retailers that who themselves were kind of not as knowledgeable as many people think they should have been about the digital television transition. The full report is on the website, and it turns out that there have been a number of things that have been learned, a lot of progress that's been made by this group and this initiative that's made a big difference, particularly to the neediest communities that supposedly the DTV Converter Box program was going to try to address. One of the problems that was very highlighted, and one that I had not quite talked about directly, but which I had kind of alluded to, was the fact that there was going to be a lot more to a successful digital television transition, meaning that poor people wouldn't lose their TV sets and never get them back. There would be a lot of hinging on that success, and it would require a lot more than just getting the money and getting the boxes to people. You would also need to have, even if that were successful, suppose you got those converter boxes and those coupons to the neediest people who needed them. Can they install it? Can they establish them in? Can they get them to work? And not just to get them to work with various television sets, but also with various antennas and various other varying technical infrastructures for which there's a lot of variation and a lot of problems that can go wrong, a lot of diagnoses for figuring out a suitable suitable way to bring the necessary technical infrastructure in play here. And MAGNET groups had talked about how it wasn't just... It didn't just end with getting the money and getting the converter boxes, which had been the larger framework. So they were able to learn this and actually raise this as an issue. I also particularly like, and I'm going to pretend to remove from myself the attached place here as a commentator, but also the fact that there are racial and economic inequities and resulting disparities in the DTV transition. This was the biggest concern that at least I had regarding the digital television transition, that it was poised to widen the digital divide in the United States, and not just thinking that it's a matter about computers and internet access, although it certainly is that to a great extent. But now also, since all media are very well poised to become digital, television being probably the most prominent example of that, that fact is going to also play into a digital divide, which has a serious race and class component to it. And so trying to address that economic inequity, the policies that help to shape that, and ways to try to address that, this campaign being just one example of a number of examples that can be done, is a great thing, and that should be highlighted and continued. What's to happen this week? Well, unfortunately, we don't know. The fact that there are far fewer millions who stand to be impacted, at least on the surface of it, from the reports that we've received, is a good thing. But the fact is that there will probably be millions of people who looks like will be left out. The impact of what that's going to shape out to be remains to be seen. Whether or not the government or entities or even community groups or anyone can fully address this is an issue that might be too hard to tackle. The ramifications of this could be well far-reached. And unfortunately, it's too soon to tell exactly where, at least as we report this now, what the directions here that we see. The hope will be that whatever may happen, good or bad, the energy that may be released from that can be harnessed into positive ways that would help to address the racial and economic inequities of which the digital divide and the digital television transition are a reflection of, and also to work to help to improve those inequities and enact policies at various levels and at various entities to help to address these issues and solve them for the future. That was a monologue that I gave about the U.S. digital television transition recorded on June 7, 2009. To learn more about the U.S. digital transition and about Magnet, go online to mag-net.org, mag-net.org, or to the website of DTV Red Alert, online at dtvredalert.org. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.